So when I reflect back on my practice of the last 8 years, one of the areas that has really shifted for me is my relationship to metta, or loving kindness. And initially, I found the practice of metta to be quite difficult. To even wish myself well was quite hard. And now I find it to be perfectly natural to wish myself happiness and well-being. So I thought I'd talk about that, how that has shifted for me. So I guess we could call this talk a journey with metta. So just in case some of you are unfamiliar with metta or loving kindness, the practice of metta is a reflective practice that in which you consciously think thoughts of goodwill for yourself and for other people. And typically you start with yourself because it's supposed to be easier to start with yourself. And you consciously think very simple phrases. May I be happy? May I be healthy? May I be safe? May I be at ease? And after spending some time with yourself, you open it up to dear friends, a benefactor, and from there, those again are supposed to be people that it's fairly easy to do the metta for. In the metta practice, the idea is to do what's easiest. So you start with yourself, that's pretty easy, then move to a benefactor, someone who's been supportive of you, who you know cares for you, to friends. And then you'd move to neutral people. And from there to a difficult person. In the Pali text, it's actually called enemy. You move to your enemy to wish your enemy loving kindness. So that's the formal practice, just a very brief description of the formal practice. Oh, and from there you go to all beings. Instead of specific people, you move to all beings, wishing all beings loving kindness. So I was introduced to this practice through both retreats and through a class that I took with Gil very early in my practice. I took a 5-week class with him where he went through the instructions. And in that class, I kind of quickly discovered this was not an easy practice for me. I found saying the phrases to not invoke any sense of loving kindness to myself, in particular directing it to myself. And several of the phrases that Gil had suggested, I can't remember exactly what they were, but they were something like, may I be happy, may I be filled with joy, may I be healthy, may I live with ease, or something along those lines. And the first two phrases in particular, may I be happy, may I be filled with joy, there was so much resistance to feeling that, experiencing that, that it was hard to even say the phrases. And Gil said, oh, you can just drop them. Don't worry about it. Just drop those phrases. And so I started to practice a little bit of that attempt and thinking, oh, I can drop those phrases. But immediately there was this response in my mind that said, don't give up on yourself. And I thought, oh, there's that loving kindness right there. That thought, don't give up on yourself. And so there was a little bit of a feeling of, oh, this is what it might feel like. But still, this was not a natural practice for me. And basically, after that 5-week class, I didn't do much with it. And the other place I was introduced to it was on retreats. And my first year of practice, I actually sat quite a number of retreats, about 5 10-day retreats the course of that year. So I got a lot of an introduction to how they teach it on Vipassana retreats, how they teach metta on Vipassana retreats. Typically what they do in that situation is one meditation period a day, there'll be a guided meditation, guided metta meditation, where they actually say the phrases for you pretty much throughout the course of the meditation. And this drove me nuts. I was very annoyed by hearing them say the phrases and the tone of voice that they used. May I be happy? Just really, really drove me nuts. So I kind of tuned them out And sometimes I wouldn't even go to that sitting, just because it was not my thing. So that was my early. There was one retreat where one of the teachers did say something that clicked with me a little bit. It was a retreat with Joseph Goldstein, and his initial instruction for the metta was, for the first being you send metta to, pick a being that makes you smile. And my cat popped into my mind. And I thought, oh, I can send metta to my cat. And they had really clearly said you didn't have to send metta to people. It could be any being. So I realized I could feel metta for my cat. I had recognized in doing the metta for people that I felt that my relationships with people were kind of complicated. So whenever I tried to wish somebody well, or even wish myself well, what came up were all the reasons why that wasn't going to work. With my closest friends and my family in particular, that was difficult. I kind of felt like happiness was a zero-sum game. That if I was happy, it meant my friends weren't happy. And if my friends were happy, it meant I wasn't happy. So wishing myself happiness meant I was wishing my friends horrible things, and wishing my friends and my family happiness meant I was wishing myself unhappiness. So my cat I had a very uncomplicated relationship with, and I could wish my cat happiness. At one point, I did a day-long retreat with Guy Armstrong on metta. And he was pretty clear in the instructions and the initial instructions he gave to kind of set up the metta were very helpful for me. He talked about, there were two, let's see if I can remember them, there were two aspects. There was the thinking, remembering positive things you had done, so something good you had done, thinking back. And so that was one. And the other was to think about qualities of yourself that you like. And those two pieces, I could do that. And for a little while that day, I could actually feel a little bit of metta for myself because of that kind of setting up. And I kept going back to that setup procedure for the metta. The suttas say that the proximate cause for metta is seeing the good in someone. And so that's what essentially he was recommending. See the good in yourself, and metta will naturally follow. But as the day progressed, I found it got harder and harder and harder to do the metta. It began to feel like there was a vice squeezing around my chest. And then, as particular as we opened it up to friends, to benefactor, it got tighter and tighter. And by the middle of the day, a little after lunch, the pain, it was physical pain. The physical pain was so intense that it just drove the phrases right out of my mind. I could not even remember the thoughts I was supposed to be thinking. Guy earlier in the day had mentioned something you might do if it was difficult for you. And one of the things he suggested, there were two, he said, try compassion practice. And the other was to go back to mindfulness practice. So I tried the compassion practice first, which is basically just to say, may I be free from this suffering, over and over again. And that I could do. I could remember that phrase. And there was a very strong wish that I would not have to experience this strong physical pain. So that feeling of contraction in the chest was quite surprising to me. And I came upon it again the first long retreat I did, my first 3-month course at IMS. I wasn't doing metta practice there. I was pretty much doing vipassana, and I did attend the weekly. We had one guided meditation a week with Brahmavihara practice, or we started with metta and then moved to compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, the four Brahmaviharas. And I went to that session, but basically dropped it for the rest of the time. So I was pretty much strictly practicing vipassana on that retreat. And the mind was settling and getting quite calm. And then at some point, a couple weeks into the retreat, this feeling of contraction became the predominant experience. The mind had been getting very, very quiet, very calm. I was seeing a lot of detail in my experience. And suddenly there was this really gross painful sensation. And I just practiced mindfulness with it. It was clear it was a similar sensation that I had experienced in the metta day long that I had done with Guy. But I just realized, oh, well, okay, this is what's happening now. And I just remember doing walking, doing the walking meditation, feeling this pain and realizing, well, at least I'm cultivating patience. It wasn't really going away too much. It was just felt so solid, this pain. And then at one point on the retreat, some thoughts of some friends became very strong, and I was just trying to note them, note the thoughts, and come back to the breathing or whatever else I was experiencing. Note the thought, come back, note the thought, come back. And at some point I recognized there was an emotional content to that thought. There was something really strong, really compelling about that thought. It was about some friends I hadn't seen in a very long time, friends I had been in the Peace Corps with. And what happened when I said, well, you know, it's not working to just ignore the thought and come back, so why don't I stay in the space of that thought and see what happens? And what it felt like, and there was again that very strong contraction in the chest, very painful. And what felt like when I turned the attention to the body and what was happening was it felt like metta was ripped out of my heart for this friend. Just a sense of, oh, how much I really loved her and cared about her. And after that, the contractions actually got worse. It didn't like free the heart or, you know, wake, you know, oh, now I suddenly can feel metta. It really had felt like the metta had just ripped out of my heart, and then it was like, oh, don't go there, that's too painful. But I could see that this contraction in the heart was really, it's kind of a fear almost around feeling the metta, a kind of a repression of the metta. This did not make me particularly want to practice metta. And I took the tack of simply, you know, seeing metta when it came up in my practice and not particularly looking for it or trying to cultivate it through the metta practice itself. There were a couple of really wonderful experiences. I had one in particular I'll tell you about where metta came very strong. In the meditation, I was sitting in the dining hall and basically feeling very miserable. My back hurt. My mind was caught up in states of aversion and anger and frustration. And in that state, a thought went through my mind about my teacher on the retreat. And as that, it was very brief. It was just an image of my teacher. And what I felt from that image was metta coming from him. It was a very strong feeling, very physical feeling of receiving metta from my teacher, receiving that sense of somebody wishing me well, wishing me happiness. And it was very powerful. The physical pain disappeared immediately. And the metta itself, that strong feeling of receiving metta itself, lasted for only a minute or two. But the relief of the physical pain lasted for several hours. There was a kind of a feeling of lightness and coolness in the body. So I had, in my meditation through the mindfulness, I was seeing the metta come a little bit. But still, the actual active practice of metta was so... So the actual practice of metta was so difficult for me that I just basically dropped it for a while. I did at some point, you know, doing the guided metta on the retreat, at some point I did realize there was one thing that was a little bit helpful in terms of the practice of metta, and that was to use negative phrases. Actually, the Pali words for sending metta, several of them are phrased in the negative. And so if I wished myself, may I be free from suffering, may I be free from pain, may I be free from animosity, that was easier. It was also easier to wish that for my friends and my family. You know, I could easily see, do I wish myself animosity? No. Do I wish myself anger? No. Do I wish that for my friends? No. It was much easier for me to practice the phrases in the negative. So then there was one experience in the Vipassana practice where my relationship to myself shifted quite dramatically over the period of a particular retreat. I had experienced a lot of feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness. And on one particular retreat, these mind states were just right there coming up at me over and over again. And I had always connected these mind states with my relationship with my father. It was an intellectual connection. I didn't really feel the connection. I didn't really know or understand why. There was a sense that my father had preferred my brother and not paid as much attention to me, but you know, why it would bring up so much feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness, I wasn't really clear on, but there did seem to be a connection. And on this particular retreat, right in the middle of the retreat, my father was having a prostate surgery for prostate cancer. And so I had told my father that I would call him to find out how things were going. And so I called him the night before his surgery. And for the first time in my life that I recall, I actually told him that I loved him. And that was a wonderful experience to see that it was received from him. You know, he received it and he actually said, I love you too. And that was kind of amazing to me. And the next morning, when he was having his surgery during the period of time, I started doing metta practice for him. And it was a very, it felt like something that was right then and there. You know, I did metta for his surgeon, I did metta for him, for his nurses, for everybody that would be around him. And for the first time, I really felt the connection between the metta practice and the feeling of metta, how they came together. There was an actual absorption into the feeling of metta that morning for those couple of hours while I did the metta for him. And I don't know whether these were connected or not, but in the subsequent weeks of that retreat, the feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness got really strong. They just kept coming over me, and it was just so miserable. I would be in these states of feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness, and I would just have to let them, you know, just note them. And it just seemed like there wasn't much I could do with them. I could see them sometimes coming, you know, I could actually see them coming, and they had so much momentum, they would just carry me away. And then one evening, after a Dharma talk, I remember exactly when it happened. I was walking up the stairs going out of the meditation hall, and this feeling of self-hatred and unworthiness just began to rise in me. And there's this sense of dread, oh no, not this again. And I simply vowed to practice with it. A little bit earlier in that retreat, maybe it was a week or so earlier, I had recognized more viscerally the connection between my self-hatred, feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness, and my feelings with my father. Something about the surgery, I don't know, something allowed me to really experience yes, this is the connection. And what happened in that moment was a recognition. There was a sense of forgiveness for my father. There was a sense, if he knew that the way he had treated his daughter would have caused her to feel this way? Would he have done it? And the feeling was, no, he wouldn't have. That he was doing the best he could. And there was a sense of real compassion for him and a feeling of forgiveness for him. Now, that didn't take the feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness away, but what it did do was make it a little bit easier to stay with them, to really feel them in the body. It was a little less threatening to feel them because it felt like it had somehow been disengaged from my father. So I simply was more able to be with the feelings. And on this particular night, when the feelings came over me, I basically stayed up. I was realizing I could be right with the sensations. I could see the feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness arising on a momentary basis, on split-second basis. And I was just, my commitment was to note it as soon as it arose. Note it, note it, note it. And in one split second, I saw the thoughts or the idea of self-hatred arise in the mind. I saw it as simply a thought, completely empty of any substance. The thought disappeared, and there was a sense of recognition. Oh, this is empty. These feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness are completely empty. And in the next split second, there was a moment of bliss, of just, oh, just complete release from those feelings. And in the next moment, there was the recognition that the insight itself was impermanent, that the causes and conditions had come together to allow me to see in that moment that the feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness were empty. But it did not mean that I would never have those feelings again. So there were those three moments, one after another. And looking back on it now, that split second, actually, of insight into the emptiness of that thought was extremely powerful in undercutting my feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness, because they are so much reduced at this point. They're still there some, but they're not at the level that they were before, and I'm not troubled by them so much. So I didn't really connect all of this too much to metta, and still had pretty much was ignoring the metta practice. But then I went to Burma for the second time. And the first time I'd gone to Burma, it was kind of a relief because they didn't talk about metta at all. They didn't ask me to do metta. There were no guided meditation metta sessions. It was great. The second time I went to Burma, partway into the retreat, Ujjanika said to me, I was reporting a lot of apprehension going into the sittings because I was experiencing a tremendous amount of dukkha in the sittings. And so there was this kind of feeling of dread as I walked into the meditation hall of just, oh, I have to look at this dukkha. And once I would sit down and get a little bit concentrated, it was fine to be with the dukkha, but there's that going through that transition. And so I was reporting this to Ujjanika, and he said, do 20 minutes of metta at the beginning of every sitting. It will help you. And I thought to myself, you don't know me. But this is Burma. You know, you say, yes, Siyada, and you go do it. So I went and practiced metta for 20 minutes at the beginning of every sitting. And this is when I recognized really how much my relationship to metta had shifted, because I could do the practice at this point. After several years of not trying it much and just ignoring it and doing the vipassana and working with all of my feelings of self-hatred and unworthiness, that processing had taken me to the point where I could actually start to do the metta. And so I began to experience, his instructions were not the whole sequence of metta instructions that they teach on metta retreats, but it was simply do metta for yourself for no more than a few minutes, a couple minutes, and then send metta to all beings. And so that's what I did for 20 minutes. Metta to myself for a few minutes, and then metta to all beings. And there were periods during the all beings where images of friends would pop into mind, and there was such a strong connection with that friend that the metta was just right there, just a sense of, oh, may you be happy, may you be happy, may you be happy, may we all be happy. And there was one time when doing the metta for myself, I felt so much in my body that I was experiencing in that moment what I was expressing in words. May I be happy. May I be free from animosity. May I be free from mental and physical suffering. May I live with ease. I was experiencing all of those things in that moment. And when I turned my attention to all beings, it was a very natural movement to go from, yes, this is what it feels like to be happy. May everyone feel this way. It's just, it was a very natural extension of the feeling. It really showed me how feeling it in oneself is really the door to feeling it for all beings. Coming back from Burma, I took a job up at Spirit Rock managing retreats. And that summer, this is about a year ago, last summer, I managed one of Guy's week-long metta retreats. And I was lucky on this retreat because it was a very quiet retreat. There weren't any disasters. And I could actually sit quite a bit. And I managed to get into the hall for most of the instructions. And I was meditating about 4 hours a day while I was managing that retreat. And I got the more detailed instructions for the formal metta practice on that retreat. And I found that I could easily connect with them. The other part of what he taught on that retreat that was so helpful for me was to make the metta an embodied practice. And the way he suggested doing that, he had four parts to the metta, for each metta phrase. And there was first to call up an image of the person that you are sending the metta for, or the felt sense of being with that person, or the felt sense of in yourself, if it was for yourself you were sending metta for. So that's the first. Call up the image. The second was see, feel, evoke as much as possible a sense of caring for that person. Simple caring, very simple. The third was to say the phrase as an expression of that caring. And the fourth was to bring the attention back into the body in the area of the heart and see what the response was in the body of saying that phrase, of wishing the metta. And also I found that the feeling of staying connected with the area of the heart was helpful to stay there for the entire four parts. That the image kind of initially felt like it was coming from the head, but it could feel like the image or the felt sense of being with the person could come from here. And so I pretty much kept my attention right here for the entire time of practicing the metta. And the embodied feeling was very helpful. The mindfulness of the body that I had practiced for so long was really supportive for this this practice of bringing it's kind of like a embodied metta practice. I looked at it as embodied metta. So this was helpful in terms of learning a little bit more about being with the metta in the formal practice. And in the next couple of Vipassana retreats I did, there was a very strong connection with the heart. I wasn't particularly doing the metta practice, but I was experiencing myself through the heart. It was as if the heart were really the center of receptivity and understanding the world, that there was a lot of information that came by paying attention to what was happening right here. I could really, it was actually kind of paradoxical because I noticed I could really feel anger. It's like, oh, I'm feeling so open and connected. And then there's this hit of anger. But the openness and connectedness to the anger really meant I could feel in my heart what that felt like. And actually, it was shocking to me to see the first initial moments of anger the beginning of anger arising at one point was simply a feeling of warmth and fullness. It quickly got to heat and pressure, but just that initial hit was very pleasant. Just a sense of real aliveness. And I thought, wow, you know, that's the hook to anger right there. That feeling, that pleasant feeling that's just a very split second long. I don't know if that's true, but that's what felt true in that moment. So I really began to have a relationship with the heart center and feeling, particularly on that retreat, how I felt like I was learning the language of the heart. This is the way the heart feels when I'm sad. This is the way it feels when I'm angry. This is the way it feels when I'm compassionate. It really was really it was really beautiful to get that sense of how the heart communicates. So more recently, I actually realized that it was time to do a metta retreat myself. And during the month of February this past year, I went to Spirit Rock for the month, and they taught a Vipassana retreat, but I talked to my teachers and did it as a metta retreat. And there were some very wonderful recognitions there in going through the categories on a long retreat like that, you spend a long time with each of the categories of people that you send the metta to. And my teachers had me stay with myself and benefactor, those two categories, for 2.5 weeks. I did nothing but send metta to myself and my benefactor. And that was really wonderful because my benefactor was my teacher and she was there. And every time I heard her laugh, I got this hit of rapture. You know, it was like just a sense of, oh, she's happy. And just this flood of rapture through the body. But moving on to the other categories, the dear friend, that one also was really lovely. Particular friend I picked was a very happy friend. And I really could see her happiness. Actually, it ended up feeling more like a mudita practice, a sympathetic joy practice, because every time she was in my mind, she was happy. And it's like, oh, happy! Just this wonderful hit of happiness. But the surprises or the interesting pieces came in sending metta to the neutral person and to the difficult person. It was amazing to me how much caring and love could be generated for this person that I knew nothing about. And then with the difficult person, there was a sense, finally, it took a while, but there was a sense of really wishing this person to be happy. So I actually felt like this month long wasn't quite long enough for doing the metta practice in a concentrated way like this, because having spent so much time with the benefactor, the time with the other categories got shorter and shorter. So by the end, I had about a day and a half for all beings, where, you know, I would have liked to have had at least a week or something with all beings. So I'm hoping to continue with this practice and to integrate it more into my life. I have been doing that some, although it more feels like it's a kind of a flow. I'm not so much doing the metta practice in my daily practice, but there's more of a sense of the metta in my life. And as I said, whenever the thought of myself, I mean, it's so natural for me to feel, may I be happy, as my thoughts of myself come into my mind. So it's been such a transformation to see that happen. And I'm so grateful to the practice for allowing this opening. So those are my experiences, and it's about 10:40, so I'm wondering if anybody has any thoughts they'd like to share from their own experiences with metta. Yeah.
I think I'm surprised that you, maybe you did, but it didn't seem as if you had talked to anyone in the initial stages of your difficulty with metta in the first couple of years. Was there something, was there a reason why you didn't talk to a teacher?
Oh, I actually talked to Gil about it quite a lot. Yeah, and he was, you know, in the conversations, he's basically said, for some people, Vipassana is the path to start with. And that really seemed true for me, that, you know, in trying the metta over and over again, I hit so much pain that I was pretty much thrown back on the sensations. And it was so hard to stay with the practice that the Vipassana was the way to process what came up. And Gil made it very clear, and other teachers I talked to also said, that's okay, you know, it'll unfold. And that's what happened. It really unfolded.
It just sounded like you were suffering alone in your terror.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to imply that. So, yeah, no, I definitely had teachers to talk to about it. And I think they were thinking I should give it up before I did. You know, I was kind of this, I should be able to do this. And but it was very difficult.
When I first started practicing, the first long retreat I went on with Sister Ayakema, and so she was a Buddhist nun, and there was an hour-long metta practice in the retreat. And I didn't know anything about Vipassana. I'd never sat before, really. And it took about 10 to 12 years of practice. Michelle McDonald, actually, Smith, and I talked quite a bit about it, because she was very honest and said she couldn't do metta at all unless she had a teddy bear with her. Of course, she was a upadita, you know? So she brings in the teddy bear, you know. And so the idea of finding anything, you know, that you can feel love towards or open to was very helpful for me as well. And I finally did a week-long retreat at Spirit Rock with Sharon Salzberg and Kamala Masters and a woman named Sharda. And at one point and fortunately Kamala's a close friend, about 4 days into it, as I went to bed, I couldn't stop the phrases. And it was very disturbing. So I was up most of the night, kind of piercing the veil, you know, of sanity. And I went to Kamala in the morning, and it was just nice to know that somebody who really cared about me and loved me was there that I could talk to and say this. And she said, stop doing it. You know, do the possible. And that same experience occurred. You know, it just sort of took this sort of strident tone. You know, I was really trying to do metta. And then I just stopped. And then it kind of, I actually got in touch with some enemies that I had never been able to send them to, and was able to do it. So I had a similar experience in that way.
Well, thank you. That's a beautiful description. Yes. Thank you. Thank you.